Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Julie Kane, editor of a new landmark anthology, Nasty Women Poets, an unapologetic anthology of subversive verse, along with contributors Norda Adams and Andy Young. It's a real pleasure to welcome Julie Kane, the former state poet laureate, joining us by phone from her home in Natchitoches, Louisiana, to talk about a landmark new anthology. It's called Nasty Women Poets, an unapologetic anthology of subversive verse. And Julie co-edited this book with Grace Bauer. In the studio with us today, we have New Orleans poets Norda Adams, who has her MFA from the University of New Orleans, as well as a master's degree in English, and Andy Young, the author of All Night It Is Morning. Andy teaches at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, and she and Nordette will share their contributions to this volume. Julie Kane, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
This is your gang, man. I like it. Nordette, hi. I'm glad to see you.
Oh, I'm glad to see you, and thank you so much for inviting us.
Oh, and you too, Andy.
Nice to see you and to be in such fine company.
So, Julie, tell us how this energizing, blazing book came into being. It was originally intended to be a celebratory volume after the last election, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. My co-editor, Grace Bauer, had the idea for the anthology in the shower about 3 days before the election. And she immediately emailed me because we had worked together on a book about New Orleans poet Everett Maddox several years ago.
Yes.
And she emailed me wanting to know if I wanted to go in on it with her. And the idea was to tie into the election and to what happened during the presidential election debate when a certain candidate called another candidate that nasty woman. And the idea was that we would call for poems about women who were outspoken, who defied stereotypes, expectations to be nice, women who were proud, intelligent. And when the election results came in, we were completely deflated and thought that was it. It was all over. But our publisher, we had already lined up Lost Horse Press, a one-woman shop with Christine Holbert as its head. Christine said, no, 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 you know, we need this more than ever now. So she pushed us to take it up and keep going.
So it's still a snapshot of a moment in time, just a very different one.
Yes.
You know? Now, I really appreciate the fact that in your introduction, you point to some historical antecedents. That's one of the things I love about poets. Poets are generous. They're always pointing you to other books, too. And I love that you invoke that year of 1973, when those three landmark anthologies came out, Rising Tide, No More Mask, We Become New. I remember those books with such fondness. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. I was in college at the time, and I remember in my year-long English literature course using the Norton Anthology of English Literature, two big, fat, hardback volumes. There were almost no women at all in those two books. And those three women's poetry anthologies meant so much to me and other young women writers at my university at the time. They gave us role models. They gave us confidence that our voices mattered.
I still remember the cover quote on one of them from Muriel Rukeyser. Remember that? What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open. I mean,
yes.
So this is a book for these times, and the book's divided into really interesting sections, all about different passages or aspects of women's lives. Talk about putting it together.
Putting it together. into the sections. We actually went through, once we had accepted the poems for it, out of about 1,500 that were sent to us in a short span of time, we took 213. And we went through them separately. Grace and I both went through kind of listing all the themes that we could see running through them. And we came up with the 10 most prevalent themes. Things like mothers and children, politics and social justice, sisterhood, foremothers and ancestresses. And then we came up with song titles. They had to be songs that were sung by women that had to do with that theme as an introduction. And, you know, then we went about putting the various poems in the section.
And Louisiana poets and New Orleans poets are all so well represented in this book, Julie.
Yes. We have 215 poets. Two of the poems are actually collaborative, a few more poets than poems. But out of that group, I think 15 are from Louisiana, which is way higher than you would expect, you know, given that we have almost every state and a bunch of foreign countries represented. We have coverage all over the state, you know, from Shreveport down to New Orleans. Some of them who come to mind, Katie Bickham, Stacey Balkin, Ann Babson, Gina Ferraro, Biljana Obradovic, of course, Yordette and Andy, Valentine Pierce, Martha McFerrin, Nancy Harris. Those are just off the top of my head, but
these are great days. You've put together a fine, fine bunch. So let's hear from some of these poets now. Now, Yordette, I'd like to hear about an achievement that intrigues me of yours, and that is working on getting the phrase rabid feminist removed from the Oxford English Dictionary.
Well, I wrote something in my blog years ago, and I have a small blog, so I kind of forgot about it. And then this Canadian scholar was noticing the same thing, and like most scholars, he researched it and came up with my blog and gave me credit for talking about it first. And the Oxford Dictionary is a big uproar online, and the Oxford Dictionary, the head of the dictionary, the editor, when she discussed the problem, because they noticed a lot of things then in the Oxford Dictionary that were just sexist, she cited my argument. She thought that was the best argument. And when they decided to remove the examples, because it was the example, rabid. For the word rabid, the usage example was rabid feminist, when it could have been rabid fan or
Rabid dog.
Or, but it was rabid feminist. And I just pointed out in my short essay that was problematic.
I have been a rabid feminist, you know. But now I think you should refer to your blog as a small but mighty blog. You know what I mean? It's just. So tell us about the poem you're going to read for us today and what inspired it. It's so inventive and I love it so much.
Well, it was right after Alton Sterling was shot, and,
right,
you know, it was just so many things that happened, and I was reading Facebook, and some of my friends were saying various things, and it just struck me. I think the one that struck me the most was one of my friends had said pretty much she didn't know what to do, and then another one mentioned Barack Obama, so Mad being a Magic Negro, and usually I'm not a fan of found poetry, but the words inspired me, and so I started writing from then on, and I actually, some of the stuff is invented, and some of the words in here are from actual tweets or Facebook posts.
Mm-hmm.
So
would you read it for us?
Yes. The poem is entitled, Digital Anthropologist Find Our Hashtags. Dear hashtag Alton Sterling, your face reminds me of my brother, my son, my older cousin Van, my first boyfriend, the only one who ever asked me to a dance. No golden grill, but he was kind. Still, hashtag this again. At POTUS Facebook today, these fatal shootings are not isolated. Retweet, hashtag Baton Rouge. Retweet, hashtag Falcon Heights. Dear hashtag Philando Castile, after four gunshots, your girlfriend asked, "Where is my daughter? Where is my daughter?" while recording "Keep Your Hands Up" hashtag for a busted taillight, like hashtag Walter L. Scott. Hashtag this again. Broken heart emoji, wild face emoji, angry face emoji. Facebook. I wish Obama was a magic Negro. In his last 6 months, he could have waved his wand and hashtag make it stop. At Black Twitter Guru. Drake is awake. He is concerned now about his own family even. Hashtag we see you, bro. Dear hashtag Alton Sterling. I am sorry that I haven't done enough. Don't want to hear more stories. Can't remember all the names. Twitter. Advice for allies. If you want to help, do, and do not ask a black person how to fix white supremacists or these murders. Dear hashtag Trayvon Martin. At BBC is tweeting Beyonce today. We are sick and tired. They report that a black woman protesting at the mic in Baton Rouge asked, how many of you really wish you were white? They said, remarkable. At Randomly Comfortable, say no to trial by media, no to black paranoia, hashtag be colorblind. Wait for the facts. For the facts. Dear hashtag Jordan Davis, today is like, dear hashtag Jonathan Farrell, I have a dear hashtag Michael Brown, what happened? Dear hashtag Tamir Rice, you were so young and... Dear hashtag Sandra Bland, if only the cop... Dear hashtag Mother Emmanuel A-M-E, I will remember... Dear hashtag Namali Henry and hashtag Freddie Gray, I believe that it... Dear hashtag I can't breathe, aka hashtag I, Eric Gardner, I am sorry because more names.
Thank you. Oh, Nordette, when I read it, it made me kind of sit up, you know, straight, but listening to it gives me goosebumps. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. It's a stunning, stunning poem.
Thank you.
So tell me about the process of writing that poem. Did the craft of the poem move you to a different space as you wrote?
Well, it was, as most poets will tell you, you have some poems you work, and you have some poems that just come out.
Yeah.
And this poem, while I worked a lot on the how it looked on the page, and I definitely made some decisions, it really came out pretty quickly. And I submitted it to Rattle's Poets Respond, Rattle Magazine's Poets Respond. Mm-hmm. And then the day after I submitted it, there was a shooting in Baton Rouge of the police officers. And I felt, oh my God, you know, I felt really guilty, but I really worked hard not to push blame onto a particular group in the poem. So I let that go. And fortunately, a lot of people were moved by the poem.
And in a way, it's the great unfinished poem, sadly, you know? That's the thing. Now, I noticed, Julie, that this poem by Nordette is in the section of the book called The People Have the Power. So how did those distinctions, those sections come into being? Did you offer those to different poets as they submitted, or did you take what you got and divide them up into the right sections? How did that process work?
Well, after Grace and I had decided, you know, what poems we wanted for the anthology, we both went through them, just listing all the themes that we saw arising in them. And we came up with a list of 10 around which most of the poems seem to cluster, 10 themes. And then we tried to come up with song titles. They had to be songs sung by women that could serve as titles for them. And one of the themes that we saw so obviously, you know, in a number of the submissions was political issues. And, you know, we see New Orleans represented so well there, you know, with Nordette having the first poem in that section and Andy having the final poem closing it out.
Yes. And so, Andy, tell us about the last poem in this book, which is yours. It's called Woman Dancing on Her Son's Coffin, New Orleans, 1995. And I think many New Orleanians will remember that photograph.
So I saw this poem in a book that's from the collection of the House of Dance and Feathers, which is a wonderful place in the Lower Ninth Ward. And the photograph just stopped me in my tracks. Something about her whole defiance in living and dancing in the face of losing her son just kind of silenced me, which is maybe an interesting place to start a poem from. So it took me a little while to figure out who I was in relationship to the photograph. And I think that's part of what I like about photographs. It kind of allows me to think about myself as a viewer.
Mm-hmm. And I think it took you to a place that every mother fears, you know, the rage and grief of mothers.
Absolutely.
So I wonder if you'd read it for us.
Sure. Woman Dancing on Her Son's Coffin, New Orleans, 1995, from a black and white photograph at the House of Dance and Feathers. She is not in black, not weeping, not leaning against someone as she staggers, drunk with grief, no. She dances on top of her son's coffin, outside the Lafitte Projects, where he was gunned down. She dances and dances, unbending, limbs thrashing, like Kali on Shiva's ashen body. Gray clothes, are they sweats? Sway in the sunblast at noon. Her two living boys make music around her. D-boy gone. Who that killed D-boy? Who first told her the news? She can't. Some funneled shape, his horn won't blow. No lace, no shawl across her shoulders. Bare-armed, back-cocked, ass out, she dances. Yes. Another thud of percussion. She grunts, pushing him out, ripping open at charity. Fluorescent lights backlighting his arched shape. Bright slash of the trumpet. He burns with fever, laughs at ice, tracing the pouting lips. Late July, night blooming jasmine thick in the mouth. I grab another sliver, slap of snare. No, she does. It's her boy. A number now, pushing up the murder graph like a thermometer. Oh, mama, mama. Men hauling the casket bend at the knees, not from weight, but from bass thump, from tuba's fat momentum. Her sweats shift soft and loose as they play it loose and mean, a threat in the throb, the trombone moans, she's gone, past shiver, past flash of brass glint and casket shine underneath her feet. She shakes her head, look, she's turning to look into everyone's face.
So here we are, 22 years after that picture was taken. Interesting to collaborate through time. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So what was that process like?
The process of writing the poem? Mm-hmm. I think it was difficult. I was wrestling with the silences in that poem, and I think it marked a new way, actually, that I began to write, in that I started to allow some of those places where I'm questioning what I'm seeing into the piece. So I kind of correct myself as I'm going. And that was new for me and kind of exciting and allowed me a way in, because I wrestle with the idea of writing about violence and writing something lyrical or beautiful about something so ugly. And I wrestle with writing about other people's experiences that are not my own, but that move me, and how to be honest about that. I question the notion of a poet, the term witness for a poet, because I think witness implies an objectivity. And I don't really believe in objectivity, particularly when it comes to thinking about something that's in our community. So rather than wait till I had an answer, I tried to let the questions and the questioning of myself and the wrestling with what to say into the poem.
Well, one of the things I think that strikes me about both your poems is that they're both full of such unflinching honesty. And I think that is the abiding characteristic of the work in this book. It's like an I Ching. You can kind of open it to any page and you'll see this little thing, and it writes as if it were meant just for you in a way. So, Julie, I want to hear from you and from all of you. You know, we're all sitting here nodding when people can't see us. But you all read together at the book festival in Baton Rouge recently. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about the energy in that room and what it was like to have people together at last in celebration of this book.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was definitely the first time that the Louisiana contributors had come together, you know, and kind of celebrated the anthology and heard each other read their poems out loud. It was a magical experience. And one of the things that surprised me the most was the reaction of men in the audience. So many men came up to me afterwards or at our book signing saying how moved they were by it. One fellow bought 2 copies of the book, you know, yes, after hearing us. That meant a lot, that they did not feel threatened or hostile, but really supported us wholeheartedly.
Let us find that man and give him a quiz. What do you think?
Sure.
Oh, so, but Julie, you are not in this book.
No.
You're everywhere in it, but your poetry is not in it.
Neither is Grace, and there's kind of a funny reason for that. We initially intended to put ourselves in there, but we had permission to do a book of 250 pages. We realized early on that we needed to beg our publisher for more, so we got permission to expand to 300. And then we started realizing that we were going to go way over that. So kind of as a preemptive strike, we took ourselves out. We wound up coming in with 376 pages, counting the front matter. And we were so scared that we were going to have to unaccept material. But fortunately, our publisher gave us a pass. But we did take ourselves out. We took the high road.
Well, you did a great job with this. And what was it like for you, Nordette and Andy, to be in Baton Rouge?
I think it really came even more alive for me, hearing the women read, both the very moving poems and then a lot of humor, but yet making a clear statement about what goes on in the lives of women within the system. So I just found it to be very moving and invigorating.
I did as well, and the room was packed, and we read in the state capitol, so it was very exciting to feel this kind of collective subversive voice reading in one of the halls of power, and also laughing a lot. It was a really fun time. It was irreverent and funny.
Truth to power, as always.
Yes.
Well, I love seeing all these hot pink books in the room. It makes me very cheerful. This is an embarrassment of riches. So thank you, Julie Kane, so much for doing this, and Grace Bauer too, and Nordette, Andy, Nasty Women All. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us and for all you do for books.
Oh, thank you, Julie.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Bruce Dear signs his book for beginning readers, Dragons of New Orleans, Sunday, March 4th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop, 2727 Britannia, New Orleans. Novelist Caitlin Macy signs her book, Mrs., Monday, March 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Cleo Wade appears for a conversation on creativity and radical self-love with Stavona Ellum Rogers, founder of Black Women Are for Grown-Ups, and Armina Musa. She manages St. Heron. They'll be discussing Heart Talk, Poetic Wisdom for a Better Life, Tuesday, March 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Cleo will sign books following the discussion. Tom Watson signs his children's book, Stick Dog Crashes a Party, Wednesday, March 7th at 4 at Octavia Books, 513 Octavia Street in New Orleans. Tom Sankton signs The Betancourt Affair, The World's Richest Woman and the Scandal That Rocked Paris, Thursday, March 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Tisserand, author of Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, discusses Crazy Cat, New Orleans and the Birth of the Modern Comic Strip, Thursday, March 8th at 7 at Thomas Hall in the White Presentation Room at Loyola University. Richard G. Robbins signs Overtaken by the Night, One Russian's Journey Through Peace, War, Revolution, and Terror, Monday, March 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. A new reading series begins March 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Curated by Maggie Payos, Why There Are Words begins with readings by Ann Gisselson, Zachary Lazar, Nathaniel Rich, Christina K. Robinson, Katie Simpson-Smith, and Kalamu Yasalam. The Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators presents the Jambalaya Kidlit Conference, March 16th through 17th at the Academy of the Sacred Heart, St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. The faculty includes editor Mallory Cass, also known as author Morgan Cass, agent Alexandra Penfold, author Linda Williams-Jackson, author-illustrator Leslie Staub, illustrator-author Kenny Harrison, and more. For information, write Louisiana, Mississippi at scbwi.org or check out the Facebook page. And make your plans now to attend the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 21st through 25th, headquartered at the Hotel Monteleone and taking place at various locations throughout the French Quarter. The schedule is now available at tennesseewilliams.net. Also, over the same weekend, Saints and Sinners, the LGBTQ Literary Festival, celebrates its 15th anniversary at the Hotel Monteleone. Check out sasfest.org for that schedule. But the big event this week is Making New Orleans Home, a tricentennial symposium presented by the Historic New Orleans Collection and the City of New Orleans 2018 Commission's Cultural and Historical Committee. That's Thursday, March 8th through Sunday, March 11th, featuring lectures and cultural programming throughout the city. The four-day event will explore the 300-year history of how the concept of home has been central to the life and culture of the city. Events will be taking place at Tulane, the Hotel Monteleone, Xavier University, the Historic New Orleans Collection, and the Old U.S. Mint. Speakers include Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson, author of the award-winning book The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, MacArthur winner Shannon Doughty, Walter Johnson, Rebecca Scott, Raphael Casimir Jr., Daniel Hammer, John Hankins, Laura Kelly, Anne Masson, Sybil Morial, Justin Nystrom, Bruce Rayburn, Cody Roberts, Dodie Smith-Simmons, Nicholas Spitzer, and A.P. Turow, Jr. Admission to the symposium is free. Check hnoc.org for the complete schedule. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. ¶¶